Welcome to The Point Home Services, the podcast where real contractors share real strategies. We cut through the noise and get straight to the point with the contractors that are working in the field right now. If you run a home services business and want to lead better, grow faster, and stay sharp, you're in the right place. Now, before we get started, I need you to do one thing. Only 30% of our listeners are following the show, so stop what you're doing, hit follow, and let's get to the point.
This is To The Point, a Rhino experience, voted one of the top home services marketing and operations podcasts, cutting through the bullshit and getting to the point.
Hey, what's up, To The Point listeners? It's your boy, the host of To The Point Home Services Podcast, Chris Yonel, along with my co-host, who today happens to have four eyes. You know who what you call people with four eyes? It's those people with glasses. I don't have those things, but Tall Paul, my co-host, you got glasses on. What the hell's going on, Paul?
You know, thanks for pointing it out, as you always do. I'm some sort of affliction. I can barely see right now. I have to get dropped off at work in the morning right now, but I'm going to get on the other side of it. But right now, having a barrier between the world and my eyeballs is best for me. So there it is. I've got some shades on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's different. It's going to be hard to get used to. I'm not even going to lie. And you know, and the good thing is I'm not going to say anything about your hair, but our guest's hair is on point.
It is.
My goodness, bro. Come on. You woke up like that too.
A warm southern breeze just holding steady in the office there at Pulte Enterprises.
The world's best hair gel or non-gel, whatever. That's just natural. You woke up that way.
No gel.
Gosh.
Wow. Natural. Some people are just gifted.
Natural, unbelievable.
Mine's natural too.
How do I now came on here? Because I was like, man, it looks crazy.
All right, so let's go ahead and at least hop into some of the stuff. Hey, our guest is Mr. Bill Pulte the third. Is that correct?
No, actually, I'm not. I'm not actually a third. Some newspaper called me that once or something, and people have always thought that. But I'm actually, my dad's name's Mark, and my grandfather I was named after was Bill. So. There's no third or anything like that.
Then we're off to a great start.
Well, I will go in later. I take ownership of that. So I'll go into Wikipedia and request the edit so that doesn't happen again.
Well, Okay. Regardless, we have Mr. Bill Pulte, who's CEO of Pulte Capital, does a ton of philanthropic stuff, which we're going to get into. But also, fun fact I found out is somebody might be a helicopter pilot. Might have dabbled a little bit in that world with some aerial photography and stuff like that with a successful venture. But originally you're born and raised in Florida. Like I hear people talk about thinking it was Michigan since that's where the headquarters was. I think it moved, but you're from Florida. You're a Florida boy.
I am. Yes. But I'm also, our whole family's from Michigan.
Right. Right. Well, first off, welcome to the show. We're glad to finally get you on here and to share your story and kind of what you're doing with our listeners and in our industry.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so grandson of the great Bill Pulte, which, by the way, I've learned the story. A fun fact, my very first home I bought my own money was a Pulte home.
That's great.
Pulte home. I'm sorry, what's that?
Hopefully it was good.
It was fantastic. It was a great first house. And I can remember the day that, and it was like right before the big bubble, the 08-09 bubble. And it was like, I probably paid a ton for it. Well, actually, I know I did. I paid more for the inflation of it and I didn't even care. I was just pumped to have bought my first house. It was a pretty cool moment. Now your dad is Mark. You said his name was Mark. He was also in the home building business too, right? Wasn't he? But that was in Florida as well.
Yeah. My dad builds big estates. My dad's very, very talented at what he does. My grandfather and I were the only ones in the production business, but my dad builds large, large homes. And when I say large, he recently sold a home. This is totally true. You could Google it for $130 million in Palm Beach, one house. So my dad is kind of high end market. And I think he's probably top five in the world at those type of homes.
That's incredible. I mean, that is a gigantic That's a gigantic home spread. I'm sure location obviously has something to do with it being where you just said.
Yes. Yeah. Cause only, you know, that business can only really survive in a climate like California or Abu Dhabi or Southeast Florida, for example.
Yeah, it's really hard to even like understand that, but you know, I think that's something that's important to also point out. As I've kind of learned and did a little bit of research just on you, Bill, is, and I don't ever want anybody to feel like they have to live in this crazy shadow, because you either have, I think, an eye for that or you don't. And I think you've had a lot of your own independent success, and so I certainly don't want to talk about that and focus on that today versus the family history. So I don't mean anything disrespectful by that. I just, you know, you're on here and I want to talk about you.
I'll take that shadow all day long. So give me more of it. I'll take it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? I heard something that, you know, again, since we've, you know, for the listeners, Bill and I have never actually had a actual conversation other than, you know, in a chat platform. So like, I think Facebook Messenger, something like that. And then all the hearsay I've heard from just other folks in industry who've had plenty of great things to say about him. So, so in my research of listening to you, I always try to get a feel for someone's character. And typically because all the philanthropic stuff that you do, you can get an idea of someone's character, on kind of where their heart's at, and what their purpose is. And you had said in one interview, and I don't know, cause I listened to probably like 10 of them, a story about your grandpa, I think it was, pulling you into like the laundry room, and talking about like, being humble, you know, to put it lightly, because I think it was like a Forbes magazine thing that came out and he talked about, you know, being, you know, I use air quotes, rich, but kind of a humbling moment for you, or a lesson learned that you took away from that. I'm like, you know, regardless, you know, you gotta be a humble, you gotta be a good human being. Did I get that right? Was it close?
That was dead on. It was Easter. I don't know what year it was, but it was at my aunt's house. It was in my aunt's laundry room. And I remember it like yesterday. He says, "Don't you ever say that you're rich. Don't you ever say that." And I said, I think I even like tried to defend myself as you would. And I said, I was just saying I'd seen you on a, you know, a magazine cover or something like that, which it was Forbes or Fortune or something like that. This was when he first really started to crack into the Forbes 400.
That's incredible. I mean, and I'm sure that's probably just one piece of advice you have gotten, but you grew
that
up.
That reminds me of a funny story that I just read about Shaquille O'Neal, who completely unrelated, but who has had some material success. Someone asked Shaquille the question of like, how do you raise humble kids? And he looked at the interviewer and he said, "I'm rich. My kids aren't rich. They're broke."
Yeah. I think what we're going to have to do too, just because I know our listeners won't know this, is that there's a slight bit of a delay, Paul, just so you know. So we'll have to give Bill a chance to respond without overlap too, for both of us, just to be aware of that. I will say this too. There's one thing that you and I have in common, Bill. Actually, there's a couple things that you and I have in common, but one thing from also doing my little deep dive into the world of Bill Pulte, is listen, high school was a long time ago for me too. I graduated in 1997 from Southmont High School. Shout out to my Mounties. I doubt there's a single one listening, maybe one. But you and I, we both did the morning announcement in high school.
That's great. I love it.
Me too.
Did you read that?
You really did your research, because those are unique things. So
I did as well. Look how awesome. It all comes together.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think ours were probably as put together as well as where you guys came from. My school is a little bit tinier, but anyhow. So listen, our listeners really don't care about any of those things too, but it just wanted you to know that I did my research. So I dug deep, you know, and I always try to learn about everybody that's coming on. Just find some little things that maybe not everybody knows. So anyhow, again, welcome to the show. Obviously, I've gotten to know your story for the most part, and the history of your family and things of that nature. And one, I just want to say right off the bat, congratulations on your success. And thank you for your heart for giving back. It's certainly admirable. So I want to make sure we showcase those things today. But
thank you. By the way, I say I do it selfishly, though, because, you know, people say, "Oh, you're so nice for giving away money." I said, "Don't say that." I said, "You know, I do it for selfish reasons, which is, you know, it feels great to give. It feels great to be able to have resources, to be able to give back. And yes, we do it because it's the right thing, but we also do it because it helps us. So I get a lot out of it, but thank you for saying that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it is, you can say, hey, I give it that expectation, but really what the expectation is you get that feeling back in return, for correct. Giving, but I love giving. I've said even the last few keynotes I've done too, I get to use that platform to share it to everyone how much, that's a driver for me is giving back and try to create this little like pyramid scheme within my influence of giving back. So, I mean, you're doing something on a much larger scale, especially with the whole, Twitter philanthropy thing that we'll get into, but I also heard somewhere that it's like either like a million or something like that you've given away. It's like some crazy high number.
Yeah. I've given well over a million. Actually, the numbers, when you consider all the fees and expenses and all the legal costs, you know, you had to get I had to get fully up to speed. You know, I've got 3.2 million or something on Twitter now, 3.1 and 3.1 million followers. And so when you start doing those type of things, you have legal costs. So it's over 2 million now. But the published number is about a million.
So cool. Man, that's such a cool thing to do. Good for you. That's fantastic. 3+ million followers on Twitter to know that. So then that's what we need. Rhino Solutions. Shout out on Twitter. Come on, Bill. Get that done so we can bump that sucker up a little bit. I'm sure my social media manager would really love that.
Sounds good.
All right, let's get into this.
Got 1.6 million on Instagram, too. So.
Hey, we can add that in there, too. No big deal.
I think I have 7.
I'll tag you guys.
Man, awesome. I appreciate that. Well, let's get into your story, like a little bit deeper into your story. Typically, we ask all of our guests, you know, how they got into the trades. This one becomes a little bit easier to understand how you got into the trades. But you're also getting into now you're an entrepreneur, and I know that you like to get into the buying and selling of businesses as well. And so our world, I say our mine and Paul's world, is a lot into the residential HVAC, plumbing, electrical, like the residential, you know, contractors within those industries.
Same for me. That's where I've made most of my money.
And that's what I want to get into is that story on like, how did you get how did you get into that? You know, because when you went to Northwestern, you went for like journalism or something like that initially. Was that what that was?
Yeah.
So tell that story, like give our listeners the idea of like, who the hell is Bill Pulte?
Well, I wanted to go into journalism, but one of the things that I knew growing up in a business family was how powerful and how great it was to be able to have a business and to be able to use the business to affect people's lives. And so in college, believe it or not, I got my helicopter license and I started flying helicopters. And I got the idea that if I could take the helicopter up in the air and fly it around Chicago, this is before drones, if I went to these wealthy homes near Northwestern and could sell these photos, you know, I could make money. And boom, I started just selling these things like hotcakes, these aerial photos from the helicopter. I'd go up, I'd get a fraternity brother, and he'd sit in the cockpit next to me. I'd tell him, hey, take photos of this place, and I'd slow the chopper down. Boom, boom, boom. We'd take hundreds, thousands of photos, and we sold them, and we made a lot of money. So pretty quickly, I was like, you know, forget this journalism degree. I'm just going to focus on business. So interestingly, I sold a aerial photo to a gentleman who had made a lot of his money in private equity. And he said to me, and I'll always remember it, he said to me, because, you know, I grew up in a home building family. So, you know, I like to think of ourselves as more of, you know, a home building family, an operations type family. You know, Pulte Homes was our family business for so long. I'm not really like a finance person per se, although I've become good at that. But he said to me, he said, you know, you seem to be good in business and your family's done all this stuff. He says, you ever thought about private equity? And I said, no, what the hell is that? And he said, basically, you can go in and you can buy these companies. And I said, wait, so you're saying you go and you buy these companies and then you don't have to operate them and you can buy them after people like Bill Pulte, my grandfather, had, you know, built up a company for all these years. I said, you can do that? He said, yeah. So he got me an internship. This guy, he was a client of my aerial photography business. I still keep in touch with the guy to this day because he was just a total badass back then. You know, when you're selling aerial photos, and the guy, I think he wanted, he had like 6 or 7 boats, and he wanted me to slow down on his boat where he wanted me to fly over his boat and he wanted me to go really slow over each one and take a photo of every one. So I was like, wow, this guy's kick ass. So I did the private equity internship. And then I, after college, I went and worked for a private equity fund. And then my grandfather had stepped off the board and retired as chairman of Pulte Homes in 2009. And by 2010, I was trying to convince him, hey, you know, I'm working in private equity. What do you say we start something called Pulte Capital and we start investing in housing related companies? And so in 2011, we started buying building products, housing products, businesses. Now, I could tell you why I got into HVAC, but basically I didn't buy an HVAC company until 2013. And that was my first time buying HVAC companies. This was after the big boom and then the bust. And then basically nobody wanted to buy the HVAC assets back then in 2013. So I got a really good deal on that asset. And so, you know, happy to go and do it there. But that's kind of the backstory.
Yeah. So who was it? Can you share?
Who was the company that I bought?
Yeah, just curious.
Sure. I bought Advanced Air and Heat out of Edgewater, Florida. So they're today owned by Southern HVAC. I don't know if you've.
Yep.
So I actually started Southern HVAC. I actually, you know, I came up with the name, you know, I put the management team together and I'm technically the founder of that business.
They're a client.
They're a customer.
Yeah.
Not Southern HVAC, meaning the one owned that was just owned by M South and sold.
Yep.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So Fox, Fox and Fast and all of them.
Awesome. Yep. Love it. Yeah. So I sold Southern to M South. Interesting.
Got it.
What a small world. So you buy your first HVAC company. At this point, kind of all building products companies are equal. What did you learn about HVAC that kept you going deeper into that space that leads you to a podcast like we're on today?
Well, my first business was a countertop business, kitchen and bath countertops. And, you know, I don't know if you know a lot about countertops, but I'll tell you one thing about them. They're a pain in the ass and to make, to manufacture. And I own probably the third or fourth largest, depending on the year, countertop company, and a very, very difficult to make. And so when I got into the business in Edgewater, Florida, Advanced Air and Heat, and then we subsequently bought another business and grew those businesses, which we made into Southern, I said, wow, this is so much easier. Life is so much easier in the HVAC space compared to countertop. And I said,
that says a lot. That says a lot about countertops.
Yeah. So, you know, compared to home building and compared to countertops, it's a lot simpler and you can scale the hell out of these things a lot quicker than you can some of those businesses.
Interesting. So I know a lot about countertops. You know why? Because there was a pandemic and guess what happened during a pandemic? We remodeled like every bathroom in our house and then we even added one.
That's right.
Those countertops weren't cheap. Oh, and by the way, one of them was off. I felt for that guy. I don't know what happened, but they had to remake that granite countertop.
Wow.
Yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, so we just sold that asset. You know, we have a lot of these days, but I think it was December of 19, I think we sold that business. So we sold that to private equity. And that was a great transaction, the countertop business. So I miss it, but I don't miss how difficult of a business it is.
Yeah, I'm sure you have still quite a bit you took away from that whole experience, though. I mean, it's
tremendous.
Well, so clearly,
we worked very actively together on that asset because that was the first business in Pulte Capital, and you know he had retired and he knew a lot about product. He knew that was what he was always very good at was the consumer and the customer, and so we reinvented the whole product line. We tripled that business in terms of size. Frankly, a lot through the product. So, yeah.
Well, I want to go even deeper on HVAC, but before we get there, I know we talked a little about the philanthropic stuff early. I want to talk about Twitter philanthropy. Your jacket, for our listeners who are not watching but listening, says Twitter philanthropy. So this is something you're proud of and identifying as. What is Twitter philanthropy and why are you accredited with essentially inventing it?
Well, I had this idea, which was kind of a crazy concept about 2 years ago. I was at my lake house in northern Michigan. I was on probably my second or third Oberon. So I wasn't really feeling it, but I was definitely having my second or third Oberon. And I said, you know, what if we were to use this technology, meaning Twitter, for good? And what if we just put out, I don't know, but I'll give away 10 grand on Twitter. And so I gave it out, and the next thing you know, the damn thing went viral. And, you know, for me, viral back then was, you know, 8,000 or 9,000 likes or something crazy like that, which today would be kind of low for me. But, and I don't say that in any other way than just like, I was like, I had, I don't know, 30,000 followers or something on Twitter at the time. Maybe that, and that was a lot to me. But that thing went viral. And then about a week later, President Trump retweeted me. That was pretty cool. And that whole thing in a big way. So I gained like 30,000 or 40,000 followers just from his one retweet. So since then we've basically been using technology to give money to people who are in critical need or crisis. You know, social media is filled with all this hate, all this vitriol. People, all they do is just hate on each other on social media. And so what we try to be is the corner of the internet that is good, that is, where people who are dying of cancer, people who need insulin pumps, people who, like the other day, I don't know if you saw, but we helped raise over 30 grand. I think it's at 100 grand now for the murder victim in Michigan.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, and I only put out a few tweets for that. And, you know, that was pretty cool. So I love doing it. I love Twitter philanthropy. Thanks for asking it.
Well, you have done a remarkable job with it, but just like anything, like your objective is to serve people who need it and do it in a meaningful way. But there's haters out there. There's people who are like, oh, this is whatever. How are people critical of giving away money for free on the internet? Why are they critical? And what does that mean to you?
Well, they first thought it was a scam. They first thought that I wasn't really giving away money, you know, and then they realized, wow, this dude really is giving away his money. So that was the first group of what I call haters. Honestly, the hate towards what we're doing is so much smaller than it was in the beginning.
Good.
Yeah. I don't know anything about rockets, but it's kind of like, I assume when you take a rocket ship into orbit, like getting into escape velocity. Once we had punched through the escape velocity of, you know, having gone into the, let's call Twitter, like an atmosphere or universe. Once we had punched through and once we were in there, you know, people have been very supportive, but getting in there, to your point, there were a lot of haters. I don't think that there's too many haters these days. I mean, some people say, you know, why do you do it publicly? Why do you do this? I'm trying to crowdsource donations. I'm trying to get rid of the bloated overhead, the corruption. There's so much corruption in these 501c3 nonprofits. There's so much overhead, these fancy balls, all these things. And again, I'm not knocking on 501c3s. I love 501c3s. We partner with them all day long on Twitter philanthropy. But if we can truly have it be peer-to-peer transactions in a digital format, I just think that it's going to unlock the ability to take care of people who are in, you know, who are dying of cancer. I mean, so, you know, that's kind of the only whatever we get headwinds we get these days.
So you've got the channel of Twitter, you've got this peer-to-peer model and you're crowdsourcing. What's your vision for this? Where do you want to take it? You wouldn't be wearing it on your jacket if you didn't have grand plans for this model of philanthropy. So where are you going with it?
To be honest, I mean, I have a plan. My plan is to help, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of people eventually per day, maybe per minute one day. But, you know, on at Team Pulte on Twitter, we have about 294,000 followers, which I call teammates, all throughout the day, not all 294,000, but that audience is basically helping people with grocery money if they're dying of cancer, insulin pumps, et cetera. So that's at Team Pulte, and that at Team Giving is also doing that. So it's really to grow, you know, those, not even brands, but grow that peer-to-peer enterprise, so to speak, and, you know, increase those numbers. That's my goal. But to be honest, I always say that the only way Twitter philanthropy will be successful is if it's not dependent on Bill Pulte. And I say that because I think it needs to be completely decentralized. And it needs to be truly peer to peer. And that's why I'm a big fan of Bitcoin and some of these other things to alleviate poverty, is because I'm trying to figure out almost like a GoFundMe, but in a way that allows people to instantaneously get micro donations. So we're working on some things, and, you know, we do have plans, Paul, but we'll see what happens.
I mean, you just said it in a way very naturally that the objective is to try to eliminate poverty and use technology in a way to share resources in a safe, meaningful, and impactful manner. So cheers to you. Good job.
Oh, thank you. But we are only one small part of it. But Bitcoin, on the other hand, I think it's going to be a big, big part of poverty. But that's probably a conversation for another day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm in that game. So I will say this, here's how I view being vocal about giving back, because there's obviously sometimes people are like, oh, you're just saying that for the credibility or the accreditations, or just to, here's how I look at it. If the intent is good, who cares? Exactly. Because at the same time, I love the fact that you probably, maybe without what you might know or might not know, are certainly impacting or influencing someone else to go and do the same thing by putting that story out there. And
that's a fact, right? We've inspired tens of thousands, I would say hundreds of thousands of people to give. So.
Ain't nothing wrong with that.
Sit in my basement somewhere. And again, I'm not making fun of people who give anonymously, but you know, the idea that I just sit in the basement somewhere and not do that, that's just not me. You know, it's kind of like, you know, if you can go raise 30 grand for some girl who's, you know, tragically murdered in a high school shooting, and you could do it with 3 tweets, I'd do that all day long. And I do that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually jealous that you can, because, and you don't know me well enough to know yet, but that is like one of our core values at my company Rhino is giving back. We do no matter how big the company gets, we do one service day every single month, and it's a paid day. You go, all you're doing is serving somewhere, whether it's as a group in your community, because not everybody's in our Phoenix office. We have some spread out, you know, other like 30, 40 people that are still spread out too in other states. But the point is that go and give back. And it's to kind of fill their souls, one, but also just to kind of be reminded of, you know, no matter where you're at in your life, be grateful for where you're at versus where you could, you know, where you could be or the position that you could be in, and give back. I mean, gosh, it's so good for the soul. And I think that actually is what makes culture so great, is that it makes you tighter. I think it brings people closer together when you can go and give. So I commend you, man. You've got such a big, influence, it's cool to watch, man. And as I got to learn more, just to see you utilize it in such a way was really inspiring for me. So I want to, segue into, cause you kind of shared your vision with the Twitter philanthropy stuff, but just like, what's the vision with Pulte Capital? Like, let's get into that stuff. Let's talk about that. What's the vision with that organization?
Well, basically in, you know, not only growing up in the Pulte Homes business in the sense that, you know, I worked with my grandfather on it and those type of things. We had a big win there too, which we should talk about. Starting in 2016, we went in and we had to kick out a bad CEO. We had a bad CEO, but we turned it around, got the stock price up from about $17 a share. At the peak when I was on the board, it got up to about $46, $47 a share. So that was definitely a great experience. And, you know, we've used a lot of that at Pulte Capital. But one of the things in that vein that we've used at Pulte Capital is, you know, that the fish can rot from the head, meaning, you know, you're only as good as who's running the business, and you're only as good as the team. And you guys know this, and your people know this better than me, or as good as me, that you're only as good as the team running the business. And so one of the things that I've started to do recently, Chris, and you probably heard about it, is really try to partner with business owners to give them the best of both worlds, where they can retain the majority of the equity in their company, but they can have the benefit of having a minority partner like Pulte Capital to, you know, bring certain economies to scale, bring certain financial sophistication to the table, help these people to the extent that they are profitable, which we should talk about that. You know, some people are profitable and others are, you know,
not profitable. Not
participating.
Like life, right? It's kind of like life. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to the extent that they're profitable and great owners, like we have a business there in Phoenix called Semper Fi Heating and Cooling, which is a phenomenal business. I have a great there. He's a rock star. But that business has become one of the bigger businesses in Phoenix. You know, I mean, it's not Gettle or Parker and Sons or those type of things. But that's going to be a very valuable business in short order. And I've got a great partner there. But he brought me in and he was going to sell the business to me for about $3.5 to $4 million, Chris, about a year and a half ago. And today that business is probably worth somewhere on a bad day, $40 million, on a good day, over 50. So now he and I own the business 50-50. But this was the guy who was going to be, you know, selling the business for, as I said, $3.5 to $4 million. So that'll work out, God willing, you know, knock on wood, that'll be a good transaction, like the Southern transaction. And we had another HVAC platform called A-Star, which was sold to Sela, you know, as part of the whole Sela transactions up there in the Northeast. But basically, that's kind of, you know, where we're focused on right now is partnering with the right owners to go into these businesses and grow them. Because, you know, when you look at Ken Haynes and you look at Ken Goodrich and you look at all these different guys, you know, some more than others have learned it at earlier ages. But, you know, what I'm trying to help these people do is figure out how do they get to be worth a ton of money at a very young age so they don't have to wait till they're, you know, 50, 60 years old. I mean, you know, some of these guys that we're partnered with are in their late 20s, early 30s. And if they just do the right thing, you know, these guys at a very young age can be worth a lot of money. And so we're trying to shrink that time frame up. And I think there's value in doing that. Now, you can never replace the experiences and the war stories and the wherewithal that, you know, being in your 50s or 60s have, like the Haynes and the Goodriches of the world. You can never replace that. But what you can do is hopefully try to bring them to a financial event, you know, that maximizes value like it did in the Semper Fi thing. And again, that hasn't gotten done yet. We're not in market. We're not selling that business yet, but hopefully that goes well.
What is different now in this market as you look to partner with companies than when you first got into the HVAC world with your first few transactions? And what is different? What is better? What is worse? What's challenging?
Well, I saw that you guys had that Colin gentleman on from Skylight Capital.
Yes.
And, you know, he was even in it before I was in it in terms of buying companies. But I would say when he probably started buying his first businesses and when I started buying the businesses in 2013, nobody wanted to touch HVAC. Nobody. Mm-hmm. And that was really good for people like me. Part of the reason we've done the minority transactions is because the prices have gotten so incredible that the way to make money is to get them when they're small. And again, we believe that we're bringing value because we're giving them keys to make their business more valuable, in the case of Semper Fi, for example. And, you know, so we've had to adapt our model a little bit, Paul, to your question, to become more competitive in this market. Now, I think that the market, generally speaking, has gotten better because, you know, it's kind of the ebb and flow, right? You had the last time, as I understood it, I was too young to know, but the market went up and then boom, you had kind of a bubble and then you had a crash. And then, you know, I started kind of down here, you know, in the crash and then it went up. But I think that this bubble, if you can even call it a bubble, I mean, if everybody calls it a bubble, is it a bubble? I don't think so. So I think that this bubble or whatever you want to call it, these high prices could stay pretty high for a long time. Yeah. And I think, Paul, that that's more of a function of low interest rates. And I think there's going to be perpetually low interest rates. And so when you see some of these bigger transactions getting done, you know, I could see this going on for a very long time. And that's completely different, to answer your question, from when we joined in 2013.
And in the market today, is it common that people with your same strategy are taking a minority position, or is it more competitive in the majority end of the spectrum?
I mean, most people like me won't do minority because, you know, private equity, generally speaking, you know, they want 100% of the economics. But totally. As I say to guys, you're talking to a guy, meaning me, whose family made almost $2 billion owning 10% of a company. So to me, it's kind of like, you know, percentages don't really matter. I mean, they do, but they don't, right? Like, I'll give you 100% of a piece of garbage, right? Or you could have 10% of Pulte Homes, which is, you know, today a $12 billion company, right? So, you know, it's all relative. And so to me, you know, I say I'm a little, I'd like to think, I know I am, I'm more open-minded than different private equity guys. And I think that that's a function just of me managing my own money, frankly, because I think that a lot of these guys who are managing other people's money, you know, they kind of have to make 100% of the upside in order for it to make it work, because by the time it trickles down to them, you know, it's not a lot. Now, having said that, I do think over time, you know, if we're just being open and honest, and I shouldn't say this in public, but, you know, you get what you pay for here. I think over time, people will probably, I think you'll probably see more people try to do our model, meaning our model, meaning, you know, doing these minority deals. Because I think that that's probably what the market's going to have to do to get competitive. But again, I think that, and I tell our guys, you know, our competitive advantage is that, you know, we're from the trades, we're from housing, we're from home building. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of value to that. Now it's just a function of, like, you know, picking the right partners, and we could get into that. But, you know, we've just seen a lot of different CEOs of these companies, and, you know, it really is all about the horse that you're riding. You know what I mean? Because the fish rots from the head. And if you got a great, if you got a great leader, 9 times out of 10, his team is going to be amazing too.
Right. I want to come back to one thing you mentioned. You talked about taking a minority position and giving your new partners the keys to help them grow and be successful. To the listeners out there, what are those, just a handful or a few of those keys that are handed over to your partners when you, you know, after transaction?
Well, I would say in these businesses, we figured out really how to market to grow the revenue, which obviously you guys are more experienced than I am in. But, you know, from getting into that business in 2013, we've really figured out how to grow the top line. So that'd be number one. Number two is we figured out how to get the cost under control while also growing the top line. And that's very important, because, you know, I often say revenue is vanity and profitability is sanity. And a lot of guys, they want the vanity, they want the revenue. But what's key, in my opinion, is not how much revenue you're growing, not how much top line you're going, but how do you manage the costs, you know, in between the revenue and earnings line. And so we can be very, very helpful with equipment savings and those type of things to help manage cost. And frankly, just, you know, whether it's piece rate installation, you know, that's one thing we've done very well in some of these businesses that's led to a lot of earnings power. So I'd say number one is top line, you know, proven marketing things that we've learned over the last almost 10 years. Number two is cost containment. And then, you know, number three is probably making sure that the earnings are actually real, in terms of that you have the right financial controls in place, that the business is actually making what you say it's going to make, because these things are very important in terms of certainty to close. And frankly, a lot of people leave money on the table. Now, there's a lot of other operational things that, frankly, we stole from other people. When we say stole, I mean borrow, you know, to use Sam Walton, the Walmart's phrase, you know, borrow. We like to borrow. We don't like to steal, but we borrow ideas from people. So whether it's Goodrich or, you know, all the other people in the industry, you know, or these businesses we bought from, you know, we've gotten a lot of intel from having, you know, bought and operated these companies. And so we try to, as much as possible, share that stuff across the platform. So those are just a few things.
When you talk about things like cost savings and economies of scale, how much does it help that Pulte Homes is still a very thriving business that buys a ton from manufacturers and distributors and those sort of things? Does that come into play at all as a value driver for you when you're negotiating?
Well, that is totally, they're totally independent, and there's no, you know, there's no way that that benefits me in any way, shape, or form. They're totally independent, publicly traded company.
Yep.
I don't own any of the shares currently in the business. So I just want to get that all out there. Now, having said that, I do think that, you know, frankly, you know, me having worked with my grandfather us having gotten the stock price back up, you know, at one point my grandfather built it into the number one home builder in the country. I do think that when we go to sit down with people, and this is more just of, you know, our family's experience operating the asset, sure, and not, directly because of it, because that doesn't exist in,
I get it. Yeah.
But I think people, when they sit down and they, you know, they see who they're dealing with, and this is Bill Pulte, and, you know, he's got a proven track record of building these companies, and, you know, he happened to learn from Bill Pulte, you know, my grandfather. I do think that aspect of our family legacy helps, but
it's a brand thing at that point, but it also goes back to, people. This is a very people-centric business, and it matters. I want to transition a little bit to talk about one of your partners. This might seem like kind of a off the wall question, but one of the more, I don't know how I would describe Victor. I guess I would say popular, interesting, relatively polarizing, personalities that exist in the HVAC world. He's one of the young up and coming HVAC celebrities out there. Chris, of course, you know, Victor.
Transparent. Lover. You could say transparent.
Transparent. Yes. What's your relationship with Victor? What motivated, I guess, either of you to do business together? What's that partnership look like, for what you can share? What's going on in Southern California?
Well, I do think Victor is very talented. I do think he's very talented. And I think, you know, with a lot of talented people, and you guys know this because you're both talented, many of your listeners are talented, but there's a lot of envy when you're talented. So I think that there's some of that.
Sure.
Now, one of the things that I've told Victor, both privately and publicly, is if he could focus, he would be worth a lot of money. So, I think he's made incredible progress on his asset there, on his business. To think that these guys, they started it from the ground up. They didn't buy it in any way. Whether it's him or Ishmael or these guys, you know, I have a lot of respect for that. Yeah. So I have tremendous respect. I think he's very talented. I think, you know, if he continues to focus, let's put it that way, I think he could be worth a lot of money. And he knows that I feel that way.
Yeah. Victor is coming to our Rhino X event this year, which is cool. And I got to hang out with him up at True Grit and just chit chat a little bit with him. And I've told him this too. I'm like a kumbaya type of guy. I want everybody to get along. And so I think when you say focus, I'm going to relate this to focus. I think that I saw him grow over the last year. And I think that growth is the focus. And maybe that's, you know, partially because, you know, of your relationship too. It could be, but so much.
I've tried to talk with him and say to him, hey, this other stuff doesn't matter. And I think he agrees with that. So, him and Ishmael not getting along, I don't understand what that's all about. But as far as I'm concerned, those two guys, they should stay focused and make money. And it looks like they're doing that.
I'll tell you what, those guys at True Grit, like, both were on stage complimenting one another. And so, like, that was and I missed it because I was actually flying in to the event when that went down, and people, and they were messaging me. Both of them told me separately. Anyway, point is that I agree with you. Incredible talent. Victor, I've gotten a chance to connect with him, and he's a good dude, man. So, like, I really want to see him be successful. I'm glad he's coming down to Rhino X, and we get to hang out a little bit more. I'm excited to see what he does with Absolute Air down there in Southern California.
We'll see what happens.
You're smiling. So, I want to ask further questions, like, are you a partner in that business or do you have other ventures? But okay, you are. Sorry. You want to elaborate on kind of what you and him are doing together and what you
invested in that business. As I said, I think he's a talented guy. I do think that he's, learned a lot. So I'm involved in that business and, involved in the sense that I'm invested and have tried to lend our expertise wherever we can. Now, whether it's him or with other people in the industry, I'm definitely open to partnering with, whether it's Service Hero, whether it's your group, whether it's, everything, I talk to everyone. I don't discriminate or have any, I'm just here to help other people make a lot of money, because if I help other people make a lot of money, then I'll make a lot of money. That's kind of how I view it.
And you can continue to give a lot.
That's the next part of that. Yes.
And that's the model. So well done. And thanks for elaborating on that. I know our listeners will be curious about that. And it also helps kind of illustrate, as you talk about taking a minority position in a company, what that might look like, what that actually looks like on the ground. And what we see is you're making a good bet on a strong horse. And that tells us where your head's at. So I want to transition a little bit to talk about some macro HVAC stuff. We've talked a little bit about the industry. What is your view of the consumer experience in HVAC? What changes do you see, impacting the way HVAC companies operate, right? There's a model that exists today. Is that model bulletproof for the next 25 years? Do things look different? What's on the horizon there for you?
Yeah. And you can still hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I know that you've studied this a lot more than me. So in many ways, I would switch that question around on you. I would just tell you, in terms of the home buying process in the housing industry, that has completely changed in the last 2 years since this whole COVID thing happened. And, I call the coming online stuff and the digitization of everything, I say it can often be like, future porn. It's like porn. Everybody wants to think about, oh my God, this is going to happen. This is going to displace me and everything. So, it was that way in home building for so many years, and people couldn't describe what was going to happen, but I do think it's slowly happening in the home building industry. So I would just say that to your audience is that, these legacy areas that thought that disruption can never happen, I would argue it is. And we could talk a little bit about that. But you look at Opendoor, for example, which you may have heard of, and what they're doing with the home buying process, and even what the builders are doing in terms of the leads and, virtual appointments and these type of things. So that's a segue into, from home building into HVAC. I do think, Paul, at some point it is coming, but, how it comes, when it comes, I kind of think it's almost futile unless you're an expert like you are, for example. But if it does happen, okay, so like let's say not just your equipment listing or let's say somebody like a Gettle does get into selling private label of their own equipment or these type of things. And again, there's a lot of permutations here because it can, it can go a lot of different ways, but let's say that for some reason, let's assume that technology does not increase margins, but let's assume that it does decrease margins. I actually think that will be bad, very bad, if it happens. And again, I don't like calling it, because I call it fear porn, but if it does happen, that will be very bad for valuations from an M&A perspective, because right now, frankly, the lack of digitization, meaning the strong manual component to doing this, is really a value add to these private equity firms. And is part of the reason, in my opinion, in addition to low interest rates, as to why these things are trading for such high prices. So I think it's something that we need to really keep our eye on. But, to be honest, it doesn't really keep me up at night as much as it's just like, okay, that means we just got to execute harder today, tomorrow, and every day. And that's what I'm telling all these different business owners that I'm involved with now is, look, guys, I can't tell you what's going to happen in 12 months, 18 months, 24 months. I can't tell you whether the M&A market's going to be there. I can tell you it's effing hot as hell right now. But whether it's interest rates or whether it's like we're talking about the technology, all we can do is just execute today and tomorrow and try to the extent that we want it, get to a liquidity event as fast as humanly possible. And that's what at Pulte Capital we're trying to advise, whether it's Semper Fi or Victor's business or whatever else is, we got to move quick.
Is it your experience or observation that digitization had margin compression in home building for everyone in the value chain, or did some people benefit more than others?
Beautiful question. And the second part of your question was the best part of your question. which was, it depends who you're talking about. Mm-hmm. For the big, meaning the Lennars, the Pulte Homes, the D.R. Hortons of the world, you know, Lennar and D.R. Horton, they're doing 50,000 homes a year, okay? So in my opinion, for those guys, digitization was very good. And their market share as a percent of the total housing starts in the United States have been very good. However, I do believe that the small-time builders, and again, this is relevant for our industry, for HVAC, I do think that if they haven't figured it out yet, I do think that it's going to be very challenging for them in the coming years because of that digitization. So it's not entirely because of digitization, Paul, but now you got to be of a certain size, in my opinion, to take advantage of digitization. And you guys see this already. And, you know, Chris, I'd be curious to get your thoughts. I mean, have you seen this at all with, like, regard to, you know, Google search ads and pay-per-click and these type of things? I mean, in my opinion, it's almost like the more capital that you can provide, you know, and put into the coin machine, which is Google, mm-hmm. you know, the more leads you can get and those type of things. So I would argue that digitization is already happening and you're seeing that through the marketing spend. I mean, when I first showed up, Chris, you know, I'm asking this in the form of a question is, you know, when I first showed up in 2013, I mean, nobody was advertising on Google. And so I don't know, Chris, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, man, I think it was there were, it was just a way smaller volume than it is today. I mean, I started the company in 2008, so I felt like I was early in the game of doing this. But I to a point you just said on, can I keep putting coins in the machine? Does that make a difference? Of course. Yeah. The two major factors, like in the, you know, in the Google or paid world is, you know, Google's trying to deliver the most relevant information that, you know, to based on whatever the user is searching for, right? Trying to give them the most relevant information based on multiple factors. So that's number one. Number two is, how much money can you spend? Can I outspend you? If you can make both those things work hand in hand together, you can beat just about anybody as long as you have, you know, this is where having knowing the industry to create that relevancy becomes really important. And this is something that was just by accident for me. It was really, when I started the company to do internet marketing, it was just me and my wife and we learned it. And we had a big HVAC and plumbing customer came on board that required a lot of bandwidth. And it just parlayed into a relationship with the manufacturer because he did a good job for him, which meant forced me to focus on two industries, really heavy HVAC. And so every day you learned it, but I started noticing, I thought something you were going to say earlier was like, it's not in black and white. If you can outspend someone in a market and have really good search engine optimization, which is essentially relevant information, you are basically hitting Google's jackpot, right? Like that's what they want. That's like the best case scenario.
I would argue that that's the digitization. That's the digitization of the industry.
Yeah, you know, and Goodrich and I had this conversation. I think it was like, probably earlier this year about, he was like, is that going to go away? I'm like, no, it's not going to go away. That's not going anywhere. And I know he was asking me that in a question, and it's probably from something he had maybe heard from someone somewhere. It's not going anywhere. I don't even know how Google would sustain. I mean, even with all the things they have their hands in, that would impact that business model. So I don't know how that would actually happen. So it doesn't keep me up at night at all. It's something to think about. And certainly the topic comes up enough, but no, it's only getting stronger. And I think that with those, this last year and even into this year that didn't get fear from COVID and like doubled down, certainly felt the positive effects of that. And then guess what? If with the M&A world going crazy, they also get the multiple on top of making that great decision. It was like the best case scenario. And I also believe this bubble, the bubble comment you made, I don't think it's going anywhere. And because I'm so connected to so many players in this space saying the exact same things, they can't all be wrong. Like there's gotta be something to it. So I don't know, man, but I just am glad to be a part of it. It's my world too. I know I'm certainly can be an impact on those things, but yeah, I would agree. It's here. It's just now who can be the best at it. Who can win? You know, I always say, I'll see you on the battlefield.
And I'd love to learn about your stuff, Paul, too, because I've seen it, but I haven't looked into it. So I'll connect with you offline.
Well, yeah. Yeah. That'd be awesome.
And you know, and I think it's worth, you have to at least be aware of everything to know what fits your model and what doesn't fit your model. So I think that's just being a good business owner, manager or whatever, is understanding those things. But, we're about 55 minutes in. I said I will be, you know, make sure that I'm being mindful of your time, Bill. And I want to finish with something that I think I bet you from even just this podcast, I know what the answer is, but something that Paul and I always, you know, like to end with, and that is, what do you want your legacy to be? What is Bill Pulte's legacy going to be? The Bill Pulte I'm looking at on my screen with the amazing hair.
Yeah. Sorry about that. My legacy, all I would like it to be, is that I have a good family, number one, and number two, that I help a lot of people. But the first part is bigger than the second part, I would say. So,
yeah, there's something that, and I can't remember, this is because you mentioned family, it brought it up for me, because I was just having this conversation with one of my daughters, that, you know, we create this wealth for ourselves, and people automatically think like, well, you guys are going to, you know, building this up to leave it to your kids. Here's my answer to that. I like to enjoy my life. I like to have experiences. I love giving back. Whatever's left over, they'll get. But in my moment, in my dash, you know, from my born date to end date, I'm going to live out that dash to the fullest. I'm working hard. And that, yes, I will help them along the way as they get older and do certain things and give them guidance. But I'm not the bank for them. They do need to learn the value of the dollar. And we do that for them now. So like we're building that in early and they're not asking us for stuff. But that's part of feeling good about giving back to your family too, is that you created these opportunities and these moments and these experiences to have together. That's life. There's nothing wrong with that. I just like to do that with my family and my employees. In the meantime, giving back as part of the fulfillment, especially when you can pull your family into it. Yeah. So I commend you for that answer. I want to make sure that I put this out here too. For anybody who might want to reach out to you, Bill, directly or whomever, to kind of potentially explore this path of a partnership. If that's something you want to put out there, then I would say, let's share a contact info. If you'd rather us just share it in the post, we can do that as well. What would you like us to do with that?
I would just say, if people could message me on Facebook, that would be amazing. And I'll make sure that I look into, you know, check that. Or, you know, just a couple other of my partners are, you know, we mentioned Victor. So I would just reach out to Victor or me. You know, I would give my email, but I've had to change my email. I've had to change my phone number. You know, people are impersonating me these days on Facebook. I've seen that. So I'd rather not give out my email, if that's okay.
All good. Yeah, that's no, Facebook Messenger is totally fine. I mean, today it's pretty much just another normal form of communication. So
please message me. I'd love to talk to you. And I say to people, even if I can't, you know, even if there's not a way for me to invest or there's not a way for us to be helpful, you know, we'd be happy to help in any way, shape or form. So we just want to make people a lot of money and we want to help you make yourself a lot of money. And then if we can be along for the ride, that can make us money. And then frankly, we can give away more money online and more money to people in need. So, you know, turns out giving away money is expensive. So,
do you know what I just thought of this, Bill? I'm thinking back, like, you know, at Northwestern or wherever Chris and I went to school, why didn't anyone tell us about private equity when we were 21 years old? It's like once you hear about private equity and then you go into a sealed room and you really find out about private equity and you're like, wow, this is the way the world works.
Yeah. And I was surprised that I hadn't heard about it, you know, with the size of the business that my family was involved with. I mean, that was pretty wild, but I'm glad I found out about it.
Yeah. You and me both. You and me both. You and me, so grateful. I'm no longer wanting to just trade baseball cards as a little kid. Those baseball cards got a lot bigger once you learn a little bit what they could be. Listen, I appreciate you so much coming on here. I'm grateful. I love it, man. You shared some really good stuff. I love I love giving our listeners a different view into what partnerships can look like. I think that's extremely important, again, to understand options, at least to know a path to go further down. So, you know, having a resource to reach out and understand that better, I think is important. And I believe that's part of what Paul and I's responsibility is with To The Point is bringing those things to the listeners, you know, try and make their, you know, their businesses better or their lives better, whichever one, or both. So thank you for that so much. And typically, you know, listeners, you'll be afraid to reach out and ask questions for fear of sounding stupid or dumb or whatever. You got to scrap. Say it again, Bill.
You can ask me whatever you want. So message me, feel free to. Doesn't matter what size business yours is, if there's any way that we can help, we'll do it.
Perfect, man. Appreciate awesome. You extending that offer. And so listeners, take advantage of it. And Paul, I'll tell you what, I don't know if you have the sheet in front of you too. Do you want to read our review to close out the show or you want me to do it?
I do. I got it. Are you asking me that because you know I can barely read right now?
Yeah, I really just wanted to put you in this situation.
Thankfully I can zoom. So, thank you Comfort Star for the 5-star review. And if you've not left a review yet, please leave a review. Comfort Star says, I'm so grateful to have been recommended to look into and listen to this podcast. As someone said, best and simply put, game changer.
Game changer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Comfort Star. That was very thoughtful of you. And hey, listen, we do love these reviews and things like that because like, especially if we have a guest on here and you're leaving one on them, we love to share it with them, you know, because they took the time to come and share their information, their knowledge and wisdom with you. And it's nice to kind of give them that feedback as well. So I know I always love that type of stuff. So please go ahead and leave a review and be sure to share this stuff with your peers. You know, obviously not everybody knows about the podcast. Thankfully, I don't know if you know this, Paul, but do you know where we peaked at this year in the marketing podcast, all marketing podcasts and the Apple platform? Do you know where we peaked at as a home services specific podcast?
Number 3.
That would be badass, but that's not the correct answer. Yeah. The number 3 is in the answer. It's actually 31.
We are the
31 most downloaded podcast in all of marketing, and we're home services specific. And listeners, we appreciate you so much. That's totally because of you and our guests like Bill we have on the show bringing the fire content to bring you listeners back listening time and time again. So Bill, again, appreciate you so much. Thanks for coming on,
Thank you, my man.
TP, I appreciate you, bro. It's the new year. The time this podcast is out, it is officially 2022. We are excited for the year ahead of you, listeners. We got some great guests coming on again throughout the year. And listen, we hope you guys and gals crush 2022. Until next time, we'll see ya. Listeners, thank you so much again for listening to this podcast week after week. We are extremely grateful. Again, the whole purpose of this podcast is to give back to the home services industry that we love so much, whether you're a rhino or not. We really, really appreciate all the subscribers. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please go in and subscribe and you'll get all the episodes sent to you automatically weekly. Also, we have really enjoyed your feedback. It's so meaningful for us when we get to read the nice comments that you guys put. So keep doing that. And if you don't know how to do it, here's what you got to do. You search for To The Point Home Services on Apple Podcasts. You click on our profile, scroll all the way down to the bottom, and hit write a review. And be honest and share your story and how the podcast has impacted you and your business. Thanks again from the bottom of our hearts at To The Point Home Services Podcast. We appreciate you. Welcome To The Point Home Services, the podcast where real contractors share real strategies. We cut through the noise and get straight to the point with the contractors that are working in the field right now. If you run a home services business and want to lead better, grow faster, and stay sharp, you're in the right place. Now, before we get started, I need you to do one thing. Only 30% of our listeners are following the show. So stop what you're doing, hit follow, and let's get to the point.